Welcome to the Simply Financial Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Calandra. This is episode number 38 of season number 4. Welcome to today's episode. My guest today is Taylor Proctor. She is a fellow podcaster. Her show is Happiness Abound, and she works as a transformational, it's a tough word for me to say, I struggled with that, hopefully I did okay, a transformational happiness mentor who transformed her own life and now has a show designed and a Facebook community designed to help people with actionable insights while breaking down the real emotions, mindset, personal leadership, and mental toughness that is needed to live a life of happiness. And I wanted to have her on because we're recording this at a time when the country is still dealing with the pandemic and the economic shutdown and the aftermath of all that has happened so far in 2020. And for many people, this has been an incredibly difficult year. And there's a wide spectrum. Some people have literally lost loved ones, to others that are just a little stressed out by everything that is going on. But it's a really difficult year. So I wanted to have Taylor on to talk about some of the things that I've thought about through this as I've interacted with my clients. So I'm really, really happy to have her on. Thank you so much, Taylor, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited and honored to be on the show today.
Very good. Could you tell I struggled with that word transformational? It's kind of a long word for me.
Not at all. You did it wonderfully.
So just to kind of set the stage, you have a wonderful podcast called Happiness Abound. Tell me about the show's origins and how long have you been doing it?
Yeah. So the origins are much deeper than just wanting to start a podcast. It, of course, starts with my own journey for my own desire of happiness. I was incredibly angry and frustrated at the world. I had built angry habitual routines into my life where I would be angry at the drop of a hat. I would feel frustration and then I'd feel sad and then I didn't want to feel sad. So I'd protect myself with anger. And it was this cycle where I really just lived in a space of unhappiness. It took my husband saying to me, "Hey, where did you go? Because I used to be happy. Where did you go? You were angry all the time." And I realized that he was right. And it took several times of him bringing this up to me over several years. It wasn't like he said that and the flip switch. I was like, "I want to be happy." It was more like he said that and I was like, "You're wrong. I'm totally fine. What's wrong? There's something wrong with you, not with me." But over several years, and he'd brought it up a couple of times, I realized, as he had said it that last time, that I wasn't happy. I was angry and bitter and resentful and frustrated, and I was putting off the things I really cared about. I was so mad at the world, and I took a step back and went, "Okay, what do I really want? I really just want to be happy." And I had this expectation that happiness should be inherent. And there's this line in the sand that the desire to be happy is inherent. However, happiness itself is not. And if you can take that expectation that happiness is inherent and put an X through it and realize that happiness can be a learned skill, that puts it back into your control. And then you can learn what you need to learn to build happiness habits and routines. So that's what I started doing. And I realized, I shut down that first expectation, realized if I thought happiness could be a learned skill, that I could transform my life. And so over a series of years, I started to take the steps, the habitual happiness habits, and really build a life of happiness for myself. And then I looked back and went, I can't be the only one who has felt that way. I can't be the only person who was angry, that was frustrated, that put off my goals, that was having a relationship suffer because I was unhappy, that was having my work life, my professional career suffer because nobody wants to work with or give jobs to someone who's angry all the time. So I was losing out financially. I was losing out in my career. I was losing out in my relationships. I was eating food and not being healthy in certain ways. And because I was trying to suppress all the anger and just trying to like not have to feel anything. And so I was suffering physically too. And I realized that I can't be the only person who had felt that way. And so I started my podcast and my company, both by the same name, Happiness Abound, to help other people who were like me work through those expectations and discover their own personal happiness. So I started my podcast about 3 years ago, became a certified mentor about 6 months into starting the podcast. It was never about the podcast being for my business so much, but more of like, hey, how can I continue to help people and provide actionable tips and insights in these areas of happiness? So I've been doing it for 3 years, and that's really what started it. Just a realization that I had come so far in my journey, there had to be other people out there like me, and I wanted to help them and hopefully speed their journey up. It took me 5 years to be able to get to a point where I could look back and go, I feel like I'm pretty happy now. I have some good routines, and I can help my clients now and those listeners to the podcast do that in much shorter of a time.
So Taylor, this is a question that I wouldn't have expected to ask, but hearing you speak and you're so genuine, it's wonderful. Would you call your period of unhappiness as a phase? And would you say that when you were younger, your teens and college years, would you have described yourself as unhappy? And then at some point you ended up kind of in a phase or a funk, but would you describe it as a phase? I guess is my primary question.
No, I would describe it as a habit. So okay. I was happy, go lucky, hyper, outgoing, all of these things that are natural in my personality when I was younger, when I was in high school and early college, but then life comes and hits you. And I had an early divorce. I had a job upheaval. I had a family member pass away. I had quite a few things go down that just life comes at you. And I took those moments, and instead of taking a route to explore why I was feeling the way I was feeling and all the things that I would do now, I just fell into this pattern, this routine, this habit of using anger to cover how I was really feeling, which then turned to anger all the time. So I wouldn't necessarily say it was a phase, but I would say it was a habit that I cultivated that I've now had to turn around and habitualize happiness instead.
And how old were you during this period when you had these bad habits that culminated in you and your husband saying, hey, you got to kind of change things? Were you in your late 20s or 30s, 40s? I don't know how old you are now, but
late 20s. So late 20s. Okay. I was about, I would say in the range of 24 to 28, in that range where it was like, wow, this is really rough. I mean, I was angry leading up to that, but those were probably the most rough years. And those were years too, where I was running my own business as a wedding planner. And I look back and I go, wow, I was a great wedding planner. I loved the business. I loved working with my clients. But my habits of anger were crossing over into my ability to work with other vendors, to build relationships there, to feel a deep connection with my clients. So I was suffering on the work front very much so, that's why I feel like it's not so much a phase, but it was just a habit that I had built unknowingly. And I think we all have that in our lives. These habits that we've built up that we just don't quite pay attention to that are contributing to our unhappiness.
So what I had wanted to originally ask you early on is happiness obviously is an all-encompassing kind of topic. It incorporates health, relationships. There's a lot that goes into it, but this show is simply financial. And what I'm curious about, and I've been a financial planner for 28 years, is I'm continuously curious about money and its impact on happiness. So what do you think about money and its impact on happiness in your experience?
I think that it can have a great impact on happiness, but not so much in the way that we tend to think that it does. So we have a misconception in society and just natural as humans, we have a misconception that money equals success and success equals happiness. And that's simply not the case. And in fact, you can flip that around. And if you feel happier, you're more likely to be successful and therefore more likely to have more money. But money does not equate happiness. There's a study, 2010 Princeton study, where they found that $75,000 annual income was that threshold where once you capped out at $75,000, not capped out, but once you hit that mark, you weren't worried about pretty much Maslow's law, right? Or hierarchy of needs. Your food, your shelter, your safety, your security, those things are all taken care of, plus a little bit of extra money around those ideas of like going out for social outings. Like if you're worried about how you're going to put food on the table, you're not going to set up time to go out to a restaurant with your friends, right? Because you're trying to figure out how to survive. So if you hit the baseline of food, water, next one of safety and security, you're in a good neighborhood, you feel safe, you feel secure, then you look at how you can spend time with your friends and that sense of belonging, then the building up like your esteem and knowing kind of who you are and looking at how you can be more creative and spending time like, oh, I have extra money now that I can go and do that painting class, or I can go and do these things. So as we move up the hierarchy of needs, that $75,000 really encompasses everything below that, right? So that gives you everything you need to survive. And people have found that when you make big jumps in your income towards the 75,000, then you have an increase in your happiness because you're moving up that pyramid of needs. But after the 75,000 mark, there's not a huge increase in happiness because all of your baseline needs are met. So at that point, money does not necessarily contribute to your happiness, other than it's how you use it to move forward for who you want to be. So it's not like, well, I make over six figures, so I'm successful, so I should be happy. Instead, it's I'm making whatever amount of money, I'm feeling happy, and therefore I am successful in my own life.
I'm very familiar with the Princeton study, but my work as a financial planner, having interacted with thousands of people over the course of my career, I don't really know if I buy that. So let me just challenge a few things. Not that you are the defender of the Princeton study, but if you have someone that has very ambitious goals, you know, they get out of school and for whatever reason, you know, they want to take on the world and achieve quite a bit in terms of wealth building, mm-hmm. right, wrong, or indifferent. If they get to, let's say, 100 of the 75, I think that person would have trouble finding happiness unless they adjusted for what has actually happened in their life. So it seems to me the study doesn't take into account expectations, and that seems to impact a lot in terms of people's happiness. And the corollary to that is somebody that comes from abject poverty. They may say, boy, if I could get to $50,000 and own my own home, they will have made it. And it's really the expectation, their own life's journey. And I don't think the Princeton study really accounts for that. So as the defender of the Princeton study, at least on this podcast episode, what do you think about that?
So I think you're right. I think that if we look at it in a general consensus of does money impact happiness, I actually do think the Princeton study does cover those baseline areas. But there are times, just as you said, where there's an expectation or there's a growth opportunity, right? Go past that. This shouldn't be, I'm imagining like you and I, your listeners are well, are probably type A go-getters, right?
Sure.
So yeah, $75,000, great. But we all want to have a little bit more. We all want to go for more. And I think at that case, it's not so much of a, well, money's going to make me happy. It's I'm moving forward. I'm progressing in my life. That is a human trait. And when we are progressing, when we're learning, we're growing, we're challenging ourselves, that is when we can feel our happiness. We have an accomplishment energy around that. And we are building evidence on our positive side of our brain that we can do these things we put our mind to. We're building trust in ourselves. We're getting to know who we are in the face of a challenge or in the face of an obstacle we want to overcome. And all of that can have huge contribution to happiness. So I think that the Princeton study is correct in saying like 75 is a good baseline threshold. So if you're like, yeah, $50,000, but when you hit that, you may be struggling to like figure out, okay, so we're paying the house, we're paying this, but how do I want to go and do things socially. I want to have that human social connection, but we're kind of tight because I only have 50,000 and I bought this house. So I think the 75,000 still works for a baseline. However, it is not and should not be the end goal for your financial well-being because we also could do more. But again, I think it does depend on you as a person. And like you said, those expectations, and those aren't expectations of money making you happy. Those are expectations for yourself and striving and accomplishing and having those goals and progressing in your life, which is a core foundation of happiness.
Yes. And I think an element of that, the American dream, I think is alive and well in the sense that, you know, when you set out, you want to at least achieve as much success as your parents. And most single or two-parent households instill in their children that, we want a better life for you. And sometimes it could be because that family has a very tough financial situation. But even middle class, upper middle class, and wealthy individuals are still going to kind of have the same messaging. And so I think if you don't achieve that, for a lot of people, that will be a struggle in terms of happiness and coming to terms with not achieving the American dream. And that doesn't mean that it automatically means you'll be unhappy. It would just require an adjustment. And there are people, and I've met, that had super hard charging parents that worked a gazillion hours and amassed quite amount of wealth, but the children didn't decided that that wasn't the right balance for them, and they'll purposefully choose a different path. Their ability to be happy is probably easier than those that set out to achieve the American dream and achieve a better life than their parents did and fall short. That, I think, could cause people a struggle. What do you think?
I think that so often we fall into what I call the societal checklist. So we've all bought into, and our parents have bought into it. I'm not saying that there's like a conspiracy, someone has made us all feel this way, but it just has kind of happened that the American dream is this idea of you're going to go to school, you get your degree, then you get a job that you make a lot of money or decent money, then you buy a house, you have a spouse, a family, you get the nice car, you've got the healthy bank account, you've got the corner office, you've got the successful entrepreneurial journey, whatever that may be, but that's kind of the baselines, right? You have the nice house, the nice car, the wonderful spouse, the family, you've gotten the degree, all of these things. And in our mind, once we hit everything on that societal checklist, then we'll be successful. Now, that societal checklist, like I said, is a baseline, but let's throw in, I need to make more money than my parents. I need to do this. I need to do this based on how we were raised. That can add things to that checklist. And we just, as humans, are like, okay, well, this feels easy. I just do what's on the checklist and then I'll be happy.
Right.
And that's just not the case, but we've all bought into it. And so then it becomes this idea and this concept of, so many people are either striving for along this checklist or they've hit the top of this checklist and they look around and they go, but I'm not really happy. And that's when you can look at your own individual happiness habits and figure out what makes you happy, what facilitates that happiness in your life every single day. That does not mean a huge overhaul of I have to let go of everything I've worked so hard for and this romanticized version of like, I makes me think of Eat, Pray, Love, where it's like, I'm not happy, so I'm gonna divorce my spouse, I'm gonna go on this trip around the world, take a year off of work and restart. Like, no, you can still have all these things you've strived for, you've worked so hard for, but then it's finding happiness in the little things. So I think that was a long-winded answer to your question, but yeah, I think that it can be difficult with those expectations, but it really does come down to those expectations. Are you striving up this checklist because it's what you want? Or are you trying to prove to your parents that you can do better? Or are you trying to prove to society that you can meet everything on this checklist and you're there with the false promise that success is going to equal happiness, where instead you could still strive for those things, but you could be in alignment of who you are, what you really want, what truly makes you happy, and be supporting that every single day, enjoying the journey along the way. And I think that money can be a helpful tool in that process. But I think that money and happiness is a complicated issue, so I'm excited to be talking about it today.
It is. I mean, it's so multifaceted,
Yes.
it's a good discussion. What I wanted to ask you about is, so I'm a certified financial planner. So I'm a planner by nature, right?
Yeah.
So I have lists to keep track of my lists, and my wife and I are kind of similar, which I think is unusual. We both have a planning mentality, and the financial services industry tries to communicate to individuals, couples, and families that you need to plan with your money. And the adage in my industry, Taylor, is that most people spend more time planning their next vacation than they do their financial future. And I think that's still true today, even though there's so much information out there with technology and social media. So I was curious if you had any thoughts about having a money plan, a wealth plan, a financial plan, pick your term, but having a plan for money factors into happiness.
Oh, 100%. So I follow a methodology, I teach this to my clients, of identity plus vision plus mindset plus leadership equals happiness. So identity is kind of what we've been talking about at this beginning here, which is who are you? What are your expectations? Do those need to be adjusted? Can those be adjusted? And then how does that fit into what you're striving for? Who are you? What helps you find and define happiness? The next space of that formula is vision. So what are your templates, your standards, your functions in the world? That's identity. And then who is it that you want to be? What do you want your life to look like? And a financial plan is crucial to that because you need to know what you want things to look like. And I think you're spot on. People do spend more time planning their next vacation because it's an immediate thing that can bring them a moment of happiness. And because we're not habitually happy and we haven't done the work to do that across society, we're looking for those quick fixes of jolts of happiness that we have to like, oh, well, I'm going to plan for my vacation because then I'll feel happy. And instead it's actually, if you're having a budget, that's a form of self-care. If you have a financial plan and you're able to stick to that, that's a form of feeling happiness and that accomplishment energy and knowing that vision for your life and going towards it every single day. So I think that a financial plan is crucial to happiness because it can help set in place the security and the vision for what you want your life to be. And again, that formula being identity plus vision plus mindset. Mindset is huge on financial planning because it's one thing to put in place a plan. It's something totally different to have the discipline to be able to act on it. So the mindset around the long-term wins of what the vision for my life is versus the short-term gains in momentary happiness. Now, I'm not saying don't take vacations, of course.
No,
take vacations,
course.
Plan for them, but plan for them in your financial plan. Don't plan for your vacation and then figure out how you're going to get the money. And so I think that that's the big difference there. And then of course, there's the leadership component. If we're tying this all to a financial plan, planning for who you are as a person. So for example, my husband and I, we have an allowance for each of us that monthly we both get money that doesn't matter. I spend mine on stuff that he's like, why are you buying that? And I'm like, doesn't matter. It's my money for the month. It's my allowance. And he has the same for him. And that's like knowing my identity, knowing who I am. I couldn't have less than that amount of money monthly in my budget. I need that to feel freedom for my financial plan. So that's kind of who I am. That's my function. I have a vision for how I spend that money. I have a vision for saving it. I have a vision for where it's going to be going, how it's going to contribute to my long-term happiness. Then I work on the mindset to know that it's going to contribute to that. And so these short-term little things that I may want, I'm always asking, okay, do I need that? No. And does it support the goals and the vision I have for my life right now? No, actually it doesn't. So I can pass on that. And that's the leadership component too. Having that sense of discipline and being able to say, yep, this is going to set me up for my life and the vision that I have long-term. And so I'm leading my life in the direction of who I want to be and that happiness, not the instant gratification that we so often attribute to happiness in society today. So yes, long story short, I think a financial plan is crucial to happiness because it does set you up along that happiness formula. And it does set you up for a successful life and a happy life long-term.
And thank you for that. And it seems to me that even if you're not winning with money in the classical sense, you know, let's say you have not amassed a lot of assets yet. And let's say you even have debt. Let's even say that you have a negative net worth. It seems to me that even if you said, okay, I have a plan, I'm going to take some extra shifts or start a side hustle. I'm going to spend less money, you know, maybe cut out the latte, whatever the case is. And you start on a pathway to improving your financial position, even though you're not financially successful yet, just by that act adds to happiness.
Oh yes. Because it takes something that can feel. So for happiness specifically, I do a lot of work on emotional management. And there's a lot of emotions and things that we have that we don't want to explore, we don't want to look at. And so we suppress them instead of express them. But when we can express them in a way that allows us to get it out of our head, organize it on paper, and then see what we're actually dealing with, that is when you can start to manage your emotions. It is the same thing financially when it comes to your happiness. It can feel complicated. It can feel like, I don't even know where all my debts are. I don't even know where I actually sit and fit. And so putting together a plan takes all that chaos that you and all that extra stress, because it feels more stressful than it actually could be, because it feels chaotic in our body and in our brain. So if you can take that out, put it on paper and make a plan and figure out what you want to do, you are instantly going to go, oh, Okay, this is manageable. This isn't
Oh
as
yeah,
hard or as crazy
absolutely.
as I thought it would be. So
Absolutely.
yes, writing it down and making that plan can contribute to your happiness because it instantly takes a lot of that weight off your shoulder and gives you a direction, gives you that vision, and helps you know where you want to go. And then it's just a matter of being able to continue and act on it, which can be habitual and something that you could definitely work towards continually. So yes,
Yes. So
100%.
people, my listeners, your community, the people that you coach and mentor, money is not the most important thing, right? But it is not unimportant. And if you pay attention to it, it will serve you well in happiness and just living a fulfilling life, whether you're dealing with millions of dollars or tens of thousands or even less. It's something that you want to pay attention to. And the plan does not necessarily need to be some 90-page dissertation. There's many, many forms a plan can take, and it may change over time, but it's something to pay attention to. The thing I wanted to ask about, and you kind of alluded to it in some of your comments, is a key tenet of being smart with money is not living above your means. It's kind of like grandma's wisdom. It's been around, and most everyone has at least heard that once, I think. You want to live beneath your means. But lots and lots of people do not live beneath their means, and they live an unaffordable lifestyle. And that is shown by, massive credit card debt, big time car loans. You see it an awful lot. And it's for a financial planner, where my role is to help people achieve financial success and win with money and make smart financial decisions. It's always disheartening when you see that, and it's common, especially today with student loans being such a problem. So my question for you with that setup is living above your means like that, accumulating credit card debt to say go on vacations and to have a car you can't afford with a big fat loan attached to it, is that a common and a potential sign of unhappiness?
Short answer, yes. Long answer is for me personally, I don't try to diagnose people and be like, oh, that's a sign you're unhappy, right? But it is to me a sign that they are following that societal checklist. And here's the thing, we want to hit all those marks on the societal checklist. And if it's not coming fast enough, we have been trained as a society to take the debt to get there faster, right? To show, oh, well, now I have the car, now I have the house, I already have the degree, I've got all these things, I should be successful, I should be happy. And then that's when we look around and go, oh, I'm not happy. So I don't think it, I think potential sign is the key word there, because
Yeah,
it's a
absolutely.
potential sign of happiness, but it also can be kind of flipped around. So I'd love to kind of share my own story of this if I can.
Yeah, please.
So I was on the way to the societal checklist, looking around going, ah, I'm not happy. I'm actually really angry all the time. I hate my life and I don't want this anymore. I want to be happy. So then started putting in place the habitual things. Well, I was on that checklist, well, I had those expectations before I could pull back and look around and go, well, wait a minute here. I had debt. I was going in that direction of like, well, I mean, if I just get this car or I just live in this place, then I'll be successful and then I'll be happy. And it's almost like we take out the then I'll be successful and we say then I'll be happy in our brain. And then when you get there, you're not happy and you're like, well, I haven't finished the checklist. That's why. And you just keep on trying to jump and get more and more in debt. What I, in my personal life, when I was able to pull away from that and I started putting into place the happiness habits and routines to support the life that I actually want and that I live every day now, things started to shift. And financial well-being was a big part of that. Like the weight, the crushing weight of debt was not something I wanted in my life. And so worked to pay down debt, become more of a cash flow lifestyle. And as recent as 2 weeks ago, actually, I have always, not because of the societal checklist, but I have always wanted to own a Porsche since I was like six. And it's something I've always wanted in my life. And I just thought, oh, it'd be impossible. And then I thought, well, and maybe it's possible, but I'm not going to buy it unless it's in cash. And buying a Porsche in
Right.
cash feels like a huge undertaking for some people. And for me, it has felt like like an impossible thing. And so that now I've been driving this for lack of a better way to put it, kind of a beater car.
Okay.
And just because that's what I was driving, we were able to buy cash for it, so it was great. And as it's been getting the mileage on it, being wearing down, I was like, you know, I would really like a Porsche just to replace this car, but that feels impossible to buy cash, all these things. And I actually, as of 2 weeks ago, just bought a Porsche. And I feel like that it's in cash, replaced my other car. It's everything I could ever want. And there's a whole story there. But my point that I'm getting to is I did not get the Porsche to make me happy. And in fact, I never would have been able to buy the Porsche in cash or even been able to realize that dream if I hadn't put into place the happiness habits way back when to be to the point I am now. So some people see buying a Porsche and they would think, oh, there she's on the checklist. She's buying the Porsche and she's thinking it's going to make her happy. Where in fact, it's the actual opposite. I bought the Porsche because I am happy. And now it just contributes to going and getting those goals and that achievement thing that we spoke about at the very beginning. So I think that potential being the key word there, because it does not necessarily mean if someone has a nice car or if someone lives in a nice house that they're unhappy, but it does mean it can be a time not for us to judge, but for them to look and internally and say, am I on the checklist? Am I really happy? Or on the other side, am I happy and I'm getting these things and it just contributes to the vision that I have for my life?
Yeah. So I knew this story because I did listen to your recent episode. What was it? How being happy helped me get my Porsche or something, something like that. So it was a wonderfully done episode. So, you know, talking about cars, and I think cars is an interesting topic because Americans love their cars.
Yes.
And I have always been pretty disciplined because I'm not a car guy. Many people, especially men, you know, they like cars and the engines and then horsepower and they read Car and Driver magazine. None of that is ever, it's just not who I am. It's just not an interest for me. But, you know, I've always had a nice car. I'm a professional. And you don't want to show up in a meeting in too much of a beater car when you're talking to people about financial success. But I was always disciplined and not wanting to bite off more than I could chew car-wise. But I always had a nice car. So fast forward, I'm 49 now, Taylor. I'll be 50 actually in a few weeks, which is an interesting time in my life. But, you know, my wife and I have achieved a lot of financial success. Now, a lot, you know, to some people, it's a little to what we wanted to do. We've accomplished a lot of what we wanted to do. And we have no debt now. We're very financially comfortable. By statistics, we are rich. And I say that just because the interesting thing now is I'm less interested in the car I drive now than I was 10 or 15 years ago. Like I care less, and I'm still driving the same price range car than I did 10 or 15 years ago when my net worth, the amount of my assets, and even when I had debt, my balance sheet, my net worth statement looked different. And I think that's an interesting phenomenon. If you read the book, The Millionaire Next Door, I don't know if you're familiar with that book, but The Millionaire Next Door was written a long time ago and it profiled millionaires. And your average millionaire is not who most people would picture. It's not the flashy person with very expensive clothes and an expensive watch. And, you know, they're more everyday Americans that they're more careful with their money. Not hopefully they do find places to enjoy their money. And I kind of think like I've become kind of the millionaire next door in the sense that things that I thought were important and I was never excessive. But even now I look back on it, I'm like, and my wife and I, we just talked about it with my car. I'm like, you know, it's about the time I would normally get a new car. I'm like, there's nothing I really want. So why don't I just keep what I have? Clearly I could go out and get one, but it's just like, I'm happy. I don't really care. But it's a journey now that as I get to 50, it's just a little different now because life happens and part of it's probably the pandemic and dealing with that. You can look at things a little differently after what's happened. So what I wanted to ask you about, I'm about to be 50 and I've read, tell me if this is true because it'd make me really excited, is that most people's decade of the most happiness is their 50s. So please tell me that's true.
So yes, by science, yes. I
Okay,
think
I'll take it.
that is actually one of the things that is part of my mission, is to not be waiting until you've hit an age where you have the financial backing to be able to make an impact, right? So income and impact working together there, and to also be in a space where maybe you can take some time off of work, you can enjoy a little bit more. Like, the hope is that we can be working towards our 50s, but also feeling happiness along the way. Now, that said, studies are correct. 50 is usually the decade where people feel the happiest because they have the financial support that they've been working hard for. They're usually pretty stable in who they are. So there's that identity. They have a vision for where they want to go. They've adjusted their mindsets to the points where they're like, actually, yeah, I don't need to go for all of these things and be on the societal checklist. In fact, I can enjoy these things because I enjoy them for me. And then also they're leading their lives in a way that really supports having happiness because they've reached that point. So yes, but also one of my core missions is to have people feel that before they hit that milestone, because why not have a life where you feel happy?
That makes sense. That makes sense. And I love the part because I think there is the financial element of it. You know, typically if you've done even a reasonably good job, you get into your 50s, you have less debt, you have more assets, perhaps raised your children or close to having them out of the nest. And so there's the financial element. I think a big part of it too, and you said it, is that you know yourself. I mean, you kind of know who you are. You could look back and see successes you've had and take a lot of pride in successes. And you can also look at your battle scars, because you would have come up against mistakes you made, bad things that happened, obstacles, what have you. Everybody has scars, and you also take pride in, I have these scars and I came through it. I think that's a big part of it. And your challenge, it seems to me, that I am not an expert, so this is just average man's kind of opinion. It's tougher in the 20s and 30s because you don't have those successes and you don't have those scars that you could look back on with pride. I think that's a little bit of a challenge.
Yes. So I think there's a couple of factors there. One, when you're at an older age range, you can look back at your failures and see how you learned and grew.
Sure.
When you're younger, you look at your failures as failures and let you are a failure. And mm-hmm. So there's a mindset shift that needs to happen there, which can be difficult. But within that too, I mean, with my clients, we do a 10-week program. And the very first thing, they sign a contract working with me. The very next thing that we do is, okay, so I'm going to need you to send me a text, whether it's over Messenger or text messaging, whatever works for you, every single day of your success from that day. Mm-hmm. And I love watching this transformation because at first it's like the very last thing before they go to bed. Oh crap. Yeah. What was a success today? I got to send that to Taylor. Right. And so the first 3 weeks I get it towards like right before bed. Then it starts moving into the next 3 to 4 weeks where I get a little bit earlier in the day. So then it's this idea like, oh, I had a really good meeting. That's my success. Or I learned this today. That's my success. And I get it in the middle of the day. And then my last 3 weeks of the program, last 3 to 4 weeks, I'm getting novels of all of the things that were successful for them that day. And it comes at all sorts of times. Or I'm getting multiple messages throughout the day about a success here, a success here, and a success here. And the reason for that is I have them track their successes because our brain has built up so many negative things that we've done or that we've lost or we've failed at. And we keep record of those, but we tend to ignore all the positive things that happened. So we build this list of successes and this habit to look for successes every single day. And then also turning in those failures of how did I learn and grow? And that's a success. So building up that mindset and that habit to look at successes early, regardless of age. So that's one of my favorite things that I do with my clients that contribute to happiness. But I think also financial successes can play into that too.
Mm-hmm. So one of my favorite things is, as we wrap up, is so I'm a parent. I have 2 children. My daughter just turned 20. My son is 14. But since my daughter, the older one, was a baby, we would say prayers at night. We're not an overly religious family, but spiritual. We would say prayers at night. And we adopted very early on would be, what was your favorite part of the day? And we would go, my wife and I, and if we had guests over, or my parents were over or whatever, if they wanted to participate, they would participate. But what's your favorite part of the day? And to say a special prayer, to try and think about, what was really good about the day, and also think about someone that needs a prayer and a special thought. And it's been really good for my kids, but it's been really good for me.
Yeah.
It's been really good for me. And it's fair game, Taylor. There are some days where any one of us can say, my favorite part is now, because it's the end of the day. Because you do have days where they're tougher than others, and we're blessed. We're very blessed, all of us. But that's okay. You could kind of opt out by saying, my favorite part is now, because I'm home and I'm safe and things are good. But I think that's one of the better things we've done as parents, Joelle and I, my wife and I, because it's been a good habit for all of us, and it also keeps us close together. Now my daughter's at college, so it takes on different form now. We don't do it a lot with her, but if we're talking to her later in the day, she'll say, Dad, what was your favorite part of the day? And that makes me happy.
Yeah, I love it.
So let's leave it there. Taylor, thanks so much for the discussion. I appreciate it. We could probably go on for hours and hours, and I would be super excited about it, but I'm sure you have other things to do. I do as well. But if my listeners would like to get more information about you, where would you direct them to?
Yeah, so of course I have my own podcast, Happiness Abound, over 500 episodes, so you can learn, listen there. I also have my website, happinessabound.com. And then I have a Facebook group, which is facebook.com/groups/happinessabounders.
Beautiful. Thank you. In terms of my ask listeners, if you haven't subscribed to my podcast, please do so. As she asked, check out Happiness Abound. And if you're a listener and you're not a client of Elliott Wealth Management Services, I know we didn't talk much about our services today, but I'm a financial planner. My team and I help our clients win with money. Please check out the website, www.elliottwealth.com. And if you're inclined, you can sign up for a complimentary consultation where we could talk about you, your goals, and how we might be able to help you. Please check that out. Thank you very much. I'll be back with you on the next episode of the Simply Financial Podcast very soon.
The views expressed are not necessarily the opinion of Sage Point Financial Incorporated and should not be construed directly or indirectly as an offer to buy or sell any securities mentioned herein. Investing is subject to risks, including loss of principal invested. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. No strategy can assure a profit nor protect against loss. Please note that individual situations can vary. Therefore, the information should be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Please note, the information being provided is strictly as a courtesy. When you link to any of the websites provided here, you are leaving this website. We make no representation as to the completeness or accuracy of the information provided at these websites, nor is the company liable for any direct or indirect technical or system issues or any consequences arising out of your access to your use of third-party technologies, websites, information, and programs made available through this website. When you access one of these websites, you are leaving our website and assume total responsibility and risk for your use of the websites you are linking to. Securities and advisory services are offered through Sage Point Financial Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC, insurance services offered through Elliott Wealth Management, LLC, not affiliated with Sage Point Financial.